Accession number 29953, Reel 4.
Well, the pub was opposite the entrance to the main, to the underground railway station at that time. And it was a really good going, nice pub. You could get anything to eat, drink, and all the rest of it. And of course, at lunchtime thereby, it was full normally with people from the offices round about just having a drink. That was the only time I went in, was at lunchtime to get something to eat.
Was there a canteen as well in the...
No, nothing. There may have been, but I didn't know anything about it. I had just to feed myself as and how it suited. Just, you go along to any place where you could get some food, as far as I was concerned. Food wasn't important.
And can you remember whereabouts in the office, the signals office?
Down in the basement.
Down in the basement.
Yeah. You went in and you immediately went straight down the basement and was there. There'd be rooms off it, there's toilets and other things. I don't know what the other rooms were, but I only knew it as that and just going there and coming out. I mean, with the first V1 that fell, we knew about the V1s because we had agents out looking for the launching sites. There was this report in the newspaper of this explosion which burst water main or something like this. It was what was in the papers about it, but we knew it would be one of the first V1 that landed in London. And we knew they were coming, but we had agents out looking for the launching sites. They would send information back if they could locate anything. We got in touch with our people would get in touch with the RAF and have it bombed. And that was the connection on that side, as far as I know. We would just pass the message on from coming in to the appropriate authorities in Baker Street, and they would get in touch with the RAF to try and bomb the launch sites for the V2s, not V1s. So there's no protection against them apart from getting the launching site, which is quite serious.
And this would be about the time as well that you were earmarked for the Far East.
Well, it was just about that time we had the trouble, of course, with the Dutch set up. I don't know about it. When I went into the signal office, first something came up, and I said to Mac about the Dutch section. He said, you can try. I've tried seeing the person in charge as a major. You can try if you like, because it would be good if you did. Because neither Mac nor I liked what was happening from the messages that were actually coming in. They didn't have their security code properly. I don't know if you know much about the security code thing. It was just a case of each one had a quirk in the message. It might be that every 12th and 13th letters were interposed. It wouldn't look bad at all, anything, on paper, but that was our means of knowing that the agent was all right. And different things were done that way. Well, with the Dutch section, we were seeing that there was some of these security checks were not there. The Germans knew we were having security checks, so instead of having one security check as we started out with, we had two. The idea being that if an agent was picked up and was being tortured, he could reveal his security check, first security check, but not the second one, give them another thing as a security check, so that if a message came in with no security checks, it might be all right and the agent hadn't bothered putting it in. If it came in with both security checks there, it was all right. If it came in with one security check only, that should have been alarm bells. But the major in charge of the Dutch section refused to accept that. He knew it was all right, there was no problem at all. They just forgot to do it, and this was his attitude, and we couldn't get anywhere with him. Of course, we had nobody above us who could really push anything at that time, because I think Gubbins and Nichols were having a heck of a job with MI6, who wanted to take over even at that time from us. It just one of these situations that we knew there might be something wrong. We couldn't prove there was anything wrong. All the messages were quite all right. We'd send an agent in, our wireless operator in, and we'd get a message back. But not the other thing that was done at the main training station before, or the base station before an agent went into the field, he was fingerprinted for his sending. That they took if you send the message, it can be recorded on a strip of tape, and they took a copy of that so that we would know if that agent had been replaced with somebody else. Of course, the Germans knew that this was going on as well with us, so it was a cat and mouse business.
So that strip, that would give you an idea of his style.
Yes, yes, it can compare it with any of his other sending. This is it. But it's just one of those cat and mouse things. But we couldn't prove anything with nothing. Everything appeared all right from the messages, except there were some of the security checks not there. And this major just poo-pooed it. Everything was all right. He knew it was all right. There was nothing we could do, and we'd no proof. We just had this gut feeling there was something wrong. And of course, when the Germans overran Holland, the people, what had happened was the agents, when they were landed, actually were just met by the Germans. One of the first security lapses, they had got taught by torture or some means, got this information so that every agent that came in, and they were always the same set, arranged all this. So the Germans met the agents as they landed by parachute. And they were given the option of, I suppose, of being killed right there, or else promised to not say anything and just be held as a prisoner. And that's what happened with over 100 agents. The whole thing was really getting... It was just one of these very unfortunate things. At one point, two of the agents who had been arrested and were held by the Germans managed to escape, and they got back to Britain. We didn't know that, but the person in charge of the Dutch section did. We had them arrested and held incommunicado, blaming them on being persons who had been recruited by the Germans to come back and infiltrate. That was his excuse. But they were there with us, knowing what was happening, but not allowed to speak to anybody to tell them. And it was just before the Holland was overrun by the Allies, I discovered by phoning the Dutch section about some other thing that it was a different voice answered it, and the chap said, yeah, he had replaced this major. He was captain so-and-so. I said, right, can I make an appointment to see you right away? And we went and saw him. And we told him what we feared was the position. We couldn't prove anything, but we said, for God's sake, don't send any more in until we can get some check. All you've got to do is to drop an agent in blind, not tell anybody he's coming, and he'll be able to find out what's going on. And so he was really shattered. He promised there would be no agent sent in until we gave the all clear. But of course, about a week or 10 days or a fortnight after that, Holland was overrun. And of course, the whole thing was seen, and all the agents who had been held prisoner were shot. No qualms about it. But I don't know what happened to the chap. He just disappeared about a fortnight before Holland was overrun. Which, from our side, I don't know if we could have done anything else. We were being stymied, and we might have been wrong. It might have been everything might have been all right. We couldn't tell. But it was the only country section where they didn't use the security checks properly. Everybody else did, and that's why the security checks were there. It was not very nice to know all this had happened. You didn't know whether you could have done any more or not.
Mm. Could you tell me a little about Mac?
Yes, yeah, well, he actually, I would meet him as an instructor. He had been a wireless operator on board a cruise ship and all the rest of it. And it was a Scot in Glasgow. And well, when we were together, we just chatted away normally. But he obviously had no time for any fuss or messing around. He was like myself, that you had to look after the agents. They were the important thing. Nobody else was important compared with them. But we were never together very much. He was always somewhere else when I was somewhere else. But occasionally we'd just meet, and you just start talking as if you'd seen him the previous day. And that was when this time we met, and we listened in for this station that was non-existent, they couldn't hear before. It was just as easy as that. So I wasn't surprised when I saw him there, because I didn't know his voice on the phone, you see, or I might have recognised him. And he hadn't thought of saying who he was to me on the phone either, which I told him off for. But he really was a good wireless operator, and he did everything he could from the agent's point of view, like myself. They were the only important people that there was, and that was it. Nobody else mattered. The agents had to be looked after. He actually, when this Australian asked me to go out to Australia and I accepted, Mac heard about it and he came and he said, "I would go, not you," sort of thing. I said, "You're not going, I'm going, I'm getting out of here," you see. So he stayed on and as the officer in charge of the headquarters signal office until more or less the whole thing was wiped out. And I didn't know this, but I was stuck in Australia, in Borneo, at the headquarters of our main station there. No idea when I'd ever get home, being demobbed and everything, because there's nobody else taking my place. And Mac turned up one day to take over from me. So we had two or three days together out there. It was really very good of him to do that. I don't think he'd got on good terms with his wife. I think it was a kind of an escape that way. But he came out and took over from me, and he was there for months, maybe two or three years after I left. I was offered a job out there on the communications side for Sarawak. I never liked refusing these things, so I said I'd be prepared to take it and named my salary, which was about twice as much as a top man was getting, so there was no fuss about it. But Mac was there for quite a while afterwards.
What was his full name?
McCaskill. I don't know. Well, Ian. No, it's not Ian. Oh, God. But we all just called him Mac. I couldn't be sure just what it was. It may be in the note they gave you there, but it was just all Mac. When he came back, I was married by then. My wife was having her first baby in a short time, and we were in the house in Glasgow, and he came up to see me. Wife disappeared in the bedroom after a while, so we had a few drinks. And that's the last I saw of him. Years afterwards, there was a note in the papers that he'd been killed in a road accident. At comparatively young age. He was a good wireless operator. We knew we could get on very well together. You knew you could trust each other, and he would say, "I'll do so-and-so if you do so-and-so," and we'd just get on and do it. You never even thought that somebody wouldn't do anything. If there was any problem, you'd just mention it to them. It was a really great... With him, you could just work straightforwardly, no messing around, no fuss. He thought as little of some of the others as we did. Again, he would not go out with a fanny. Never. Sometimes, when he dropped in the odd time to Henley and that sort of thing, we'd go out for a drink together, and after about half an hour, he was off chatting some female up. He just liked female company, but he would not have anything to do with dating a fanny any more than I would, except as far as I was concerned, the CEO secretary. That was the only thing.
So you decided to go to the Far East?
Yes, well, I was asked to go. This major came down to see me. He had been over to try and get some stuff for their unit out there, Z Special Unit. Would I be prepared to come out as an instructor? I said yes, so great is the pleasure. So I had 1 week's leave, embarkation leave, and went out by America there, and eventually got to Melbourne.
Yeah, this extraordinary journey.
Oh no, it was utterly ridiculous. You know, 24 hours in the hotel in America, and then I had to go out to the airfield. And of course, to get out there, I'm told you wouldn't get away for about a week or so. I had to come back again. And of course, they wouldn't let me in the hotel. Fully booked, you know, this sort of thing. So I spent two nights in one of these officers' club things. There was about 20 of us in a room, but it was very nice and comfortable. But that's when I knew I would have no money left at all, not a penny. That's when I went to the consulate in America. They were very nice. It was actually an American lady who looked after me to start with, the receptionist, and then the consul himself came. So I just got, he said, how much do you want? And I said, something $100 or something like this. I just got them over, I just signed a chit, and that was it. And he said, where are you staying? I said, well, I was staying at that hotel you booked me into. But they say they're fully booked. Oh, that's no trouble at all. Called his receptionist, and she came back and said, it's booked. So I went back in, the same chap who said there was no room was never battered an eyelid and gave me the keys to the room. But I never ate there again. I went out and ate all the time, out the way. So I had quite a nice spell there, but...
That was in
San Francisco. It was a lovely place. I don't know what it would be like now, but I thoroughly enjoyed my time there. The rocks, if you go away out with public transport so far and then walk out the river edge and that sort of thing, it really was... I had a very pleasant time there. I ate very sensibly, if you want to call it that. You got eggs and chips and that sort of stuff with hardly anything. And I got an invitation from the consul, British consul, to come and have dinner with him one night. I got there and thanked him very much for it. Which is, his wife said, we thought you might quite like to be here tonight. We can afford to have meat one night a week, that's all. So we're having mince and potatoes tonight. This was a big treat for them, mince and potatoes. You know. It's also ridiculous, and yet that was the position. But I knew I could get any help from them if I ever wanted it, but I just stayed in the hotel as long as I needed to, and then I got a phone call to say that I had to go out for the flight, and then so when I went out, and then of course the flight was messed up, and to stay a night out there, and then we got the next plane that was going somewhere or other. It was awful standing there and seeing a nice plane with ordinary seats taking off to go to Australia, but that was the one that we would have got if we had been later and getting booked first. The other thing I remember about the flight from San Francisco out to the Pacific was the fact that every time you came down you got food, peanut butter sandwiches, that was it, peanut butter sandwiches, whether it was morning, evening, night or anything, you just kept flying peanut butter sandwiches. But it was really tragic. I didn't get that one, the flight didn't take place. I just should have got, it would have been a lot easier. But it gave you an insight into the fact that if you wanted to get from A to B, you just went down to the airfield and asked, are there any planes going anywhere? And this was it. I had to go on one of the trips when I was there, when I'd gone up to Moratai. I was told to go on this plane, which was an Australian Air Force one, to some place, they wouldn't tell me where. An agent was going to be picked up. It was a Catalina that was a plane, because he was being picked up off the coast somewhere, they knew where, and to be taken to another place where they would spend the night and then get reinserted. And it all seems so ridiculous. So we've been flying for quite a long time, because Catalinas can keep going for ages. And I knew there was something had happened in the cockpit at the front. I was in the back, but just sitting, no idea where we were, where we were going. And the pilot in charge of the plane was furious. His navigator had admitted he didn't know where they were. They were somewhere over the Pacific. No idea where they were. So the two of them were going at each other. So the navigator said, well, it looks as if there could be some land way over there. I think they can see some smoke or something. So they headed for there. And obviously, some either Americans or Australians had bombed an oil refinery or tourist banks, and this was all up in flames. So the pilot had kept going towards it because the navigator said, I'd like to see what it looks like on the ground so I can see where we really are. I know it's land, but we'll see where we really are. So we went in, and I was just sitting in the back with some other chap was there too. And we're just sitting normally, and the next second you're pulling yourself off the ceiling of the Catalina, literally hands up there to try and keep your head from bashing up there. It was one of the oil fire parts. There was this fantastic downdraft outside that just hit the plane. Of course, the plane just went straight down. The pilot managed to get out of it, fortunately. Navigator got a real swing. But you wouldn't believe it. You're sitting there comfortably, and the next minute you're pushing yourself off the ceiling of the cabin. And that was it. He said, I know where we are now. So we picked up the chap, and I was dropped off there and told to go down to the airfield and you'll get a flight to where you want to go to, and that was that. And you just went down to the airfield and said you wanted to go so and so, and it was all right. You got arranged, you got there. I had to go and see the staff of the PT boats headquarters on a ship in there. I don't know if it was Tawi Tawi or not, or something like that, in the Pacific. I had a smashing meal there, and we discussed this business. What they wanted to do was to get other people who were in various enemy occupied territory to tell them if they saw any vessels there, so the PT boats could go and smash them up. Very nice in theory. And I had a very nice meal there. It was full starter, main course, ice cream and everything. They do themselves well in these things. And then I had to go and hitch myself a lift back on any plane that was going back to Maritai, and just got back there. That was it. But the spell in Australia was very pleasant, but it was a curious setup because I was not an Australian, and that was it. And this is how things went. I landed there all right. I was introduced to the person, the British major, who was in charge of general admin stuff there. He was very nice, very good.
Was this in Melbourne?
Melbourne, yeah, very good. Everything above board. He could tell me what I could claim. I had put in a claim. He said, that's a lot of nonsense. You're not claiming nearly enough. And this was all done. We were all nice and friendly and everything else. And eventually, after about a week, I suppose, or more, I was sent up to their base up in Queensland, which is a training base, which is what I was recruited for, which it was all right. I mean, you got up to so far up, and then you had to go on a train north from there, and it was one of these ones that you stop for an hour to get lunch. Everybody got off, the train got fed, filled up with water and all sort of things, until we got up on south of Queensland, the training place there, which was on an island, which I was met and taken across in the landing craft, and that was it. You just simply did training. The person who had been there was an Australian captain, but he had moved down to Melbourne, and he was at the other end. So we got agents who were with me would make contact with him down in Melbourne, and agents down in Melbourne would make contact with me. It was a cushy number. You had 3 or 4 hours a day working, that was all. And nothing happened at a weekend. Everybody just went to sleep. Quite amazing, you know. Weekends in Melbourne, even, nobody did anything.
And these were Z Special.
Yes. Yes.
How do you describe that? Was it an offshoot of SOE?
It was their own lot. It was the equivalent of our lot, but it was their own lot, but working under different circumstances. We put people in civilian clothes into enemy occupied territory. The Australians, there was no point doing that because you couldn't get people be the same as the people who were living there. So they were in we went in uniform and moved around in uniform all the time, which gave you a better chance if the Japs wanted to treat you as a human being in uniform as opposed to just knocking you off.
And these were predominantly Australians?
The Australians, a medium number of New Zealanders. There were a few other British, not many, and there was, at one time anyway, one American. His plane had been shot down. He had been taken by some of the locals to the party next to us. Said, this is a far better life than I can have anywhere else, so I'll stay with you.
This is once you were in.
That was it. But I got up there. The training was fine in Queensland, but then after a short time I got an extra long message from my equivalent down in outside Melbourne. And when I deciphered it, he was asking if I would change places with him. And I agreed right away, because where I was extremely boring, and outside Melbourne would be heavens. So we changed places over one weekend when there was no work being done. And I flew down and he flew up. I can always remember the flight that was arranged from one flight, the first of all, from where I was. I went to the airport and there was a small plane, biplane. The speedometer that was on it was a bent spring on, you could see out the porthole, so that when you're flying fast it bent up and that told you the speed. It was marked off in the miles an hour. And I said to the chap, the pilot, I said, are you going to get to me in time to catch my flight? So he did like this. He said, yeah, if there's no fires, no forest fires, we'll make it in time. And we did make it in time. But they had, it was a small biplane. We were never any height at all. And you had to fly around anything that was in the way and that sort of stuff. It was one of the best flights I've ever had. It was wonderful, sitting there looking out. Half the passengers were sick, and he was having a great laugh at being sick and that sort of thing. And I just got there and got another plane and got down to Melbourne and changed places with a chap. But the actual training place was, I don't know, 20, 30 miles outside Melbourne. And we slept in more or less Nissen huts and so on. And no beds. You got a straw palliasse. This is one of the worst parts of it. You got a straw palliasse on the floor and you slept on that. But for some reason or some means or another, the palliasse was full of fleas all the time. So every time we went into Melbourne, we bought a bottle of this gungy stuff out of a certain chemist, and you came back and you poured it all over your palliasse, and that kept it peaceful for 2 or 3 nights anyway. But that was the situation. There was fleas everywhere. But it was quite good. But the training was straightforward. There was no problem. Everybody was very nice. I fell into the routine by being willing to do some work at some nights, which meant then that you had fulfilled all your hours so you could get into Melbourne early on a Friday instead of staying till late. And I went to Melbourne every weekend, there's no question about it. And of course you were free for the weekend to see anywhere around about and everything. was entertained by the odd person, the house and everything, and that sort of stuff. Had Christmas dinner at one family with a boy of about, I suppose, 8 or 9, and they insisted on playing cricket in the afternoon, midsummer in Melbourne. It was very nice. Everybody I found was very nice in Melbourne. I really had a very good time when I was there. No question about it.
How did you find it being a British officer working with Australian?
I had no problem at all.
Did being Scottish help at all?
It might have done a little, but not in general. I found all Australians I met, apart from one who was up north of the cat training camp up north, he was a pain in the neck, but everybody else was really very, very nice, I must say. I got on well with them. I never had any trouble with any male, female, anybody, and all the rest of it. You made the odd mistake. The first time I went for breakfast in the hotel, I just glanced at the menu because the waiter just came there, and I said, oh, I'll have ham and egg. You know, I never thought anything about it. I got ham and egg. 2 slices of ham, 2 poached eggs. It's bacon egg you should have asked for. It's that sort of silly thing, you know, but it was really quite funny. But I had a wonderful time in Melbourne over that period. Couldn't fault it. We had troubles with the training. They went out in fall boats and got lost and this sort of thing, but there was no great danger. But it just went that way. But one of the troubles was with the whole of the training. It actually did happen down in Melbourne. I had a great deal of trouble, and I managed eventually to get agreement that I would be allowed to have a talk with each party before they left. The party could be about a dozen just. I knew I'd been in touch with the wireless operators all the time, but I asked if I could have a talk with them all just to let them know what the signal officer's problems would be and everything. And most of the parties just would they agreed to me having this on condition that it was up to the party to come or not come. They didn't have to come, it wasn't compulsory. And sure enough, very few parties came. Some of them even sent the wireless operators who were seeing any day, every day. Mm-hmm. Other ones would send one officer with the wireless operators, but it was not much use. But one party actually came, and in full, everybody was there. It was a New Zealand major in charge of it. And we had a very good time talking about all sorts of things in connection with signals working, and the others, what they had to know about how to work and that sort of thing. And that was it. And that was the only party who really played up well. And when I went into Borneo, that was the party I landed with.
Was that Toby Carter?
Toby Carter, yeah. That was the one I landed with. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know it was him or anything like that. I didn't know who I was going into. But that was the only party down south that really made use of the discussions. It was